a man who had just recently retired. And prior to his retirement, he'd gotten up every morning. He and his wife had had breakfast together. Then he had walked down to the train station and took the suburban train into the city of Chicago. And then the same thing in reverse in the late afternoon. And now he would get up in the morning, and he and his wife would have breakfast. And then he would hang around the house. And then about lunchtime, he would want her to fix him some lunch. And then he'd hang around the house all afternoon. And after about 2 weeks of that, they had a verbal knockdown dragout. She just could not put up with him being around the house all the time. I mean, for 40 or so years, I mean, he'd gone off to work and she could do some things that she wanted to do during the day. And so in order to try and resolve the problem, one day he was downtown in this little western suburb of Chicago where they lived. And he just had gone for a walk, and it was a beautiful day, and he walked by this old office building. And he noticed in one of the windows, office for rent. So he got an ID, walked in, talked to whoever was in charge, found out how much the rent was. It was reasonable. It was an old place. Looked over the office. It was a nice size. It was one of these old-fashioned places where, you know, you had the wooden door with the frosted glass window in the top half and kind of squeaky door. And so he made a down payment on the rent, went back home, got his little portable TV and a lounge chair and an end table and a lamp and a small desk and chair, and took it down and set up his office. And then he looked the thing over and he thought, man, this is really neat. But he had to have something on the door to kind of identify who he was. So he got a hold of one of these guys that does paintings on doors, you know, and he had him put on the door, the glass part, consultant. Consultant. So every morning now he would get up, he and his wife would have breakfast, and then he would leave for the office. And he would go down to his office, and he had, of course, taken some of his favorite books that he'd been wanting to read for some time, and he'd sit there and he'd read and he'd do a little planning and thinking, watch his favorite TV programs, and everything kind of smoothed out at home. Well, he had been at this for about 2 weeks, and there was a knock on the door one morning. And he went to the door, and there was an elderly gentleman standing there, and he said, are you a consultant? And he says, yes. He says, well, what kind of a consultant are you? And he says, well, what kind do you need? And this guy said, well, you see, I got this problem. Just recently, I retired. And, you know, things aren't going so smoothly at home. And he repeated this other guy's story to himself. And so he said, well, why don't you come on in? We'll talk about this. So they did. They talked about it. He says, I got an idea. Look, there's plenty of room in this office for two of us. And you could help share the rent, and you could bring your own desk down. We could kind of figure out our TV schedule, and you can bring your books in and bring your lounge chair, and we'll just share this, and I think it'll solve your problem. It solved mine. Well, the guy thought it was a terrific idea, and so he did, and they moved in and together, and the only thing they changed was they put an S on the end of consultant, and now it was consultants, you know, two of them. Now, that sounds kind of humorous, and it's a true story. It really happened. But in another sense, it's a very tragic story. It's tragic because of why it happened. You see, what had happened to this couple was that over the years, in the early years of their marriage, they had stayed in touch with each other, and then in terms of communication, and then the kids began to come along, and then gradually, by time went by, and as time passed, the kids became the focal point of their relationship. And so about the only thing they really talked about were the kids and the problems they were facing, or what we needed to do and how we needed to handle this situation at school. And then one morning, They got up, and the kids were gone. And I don't mean, you know, that happened all at once, but they were empty nesters. And they sat across the breakfast table from each other, and they realized that they were strangers. They had totally lost touch with each other. The only point of contact that they had had in the last several years were the children, and now the children were gone. They were off married, gone to college, gotten a job, and they had nothing between the two of them to really talk about. Now that is happening over and over and over again in our country today. The divorce rate among people who are in their 50s and 60s is epidemic in our country. If you take a per capita population-wise in age groups, the divorce rate among that age group is higher than any other single age group in our country. It's epidemic in proportion. And of course, part of that has to do not just with this problem that I've described, but it also has to do with the freedom our society has given to that type of thing. 20, 25 years ago, there was a stigma attached to divorce, but there isn't anymore. And so couples are coming to that place in their life. The kids are gone. They're sitting across the breakfast table from one another. They got nothing to talk about. They take a crack at it for a few weeks, and finally they throw up their hands mentally in despair and say, hey, it's just not worth the effort. And so they get a divorce. Now, folks, there are some people in a crowd like this who are headed in that direction. I don't know who you are. Don't misunderstand me. I haven't gotten any inside information. I don't know who you are. But I just know that in a crowd of this size, there are some of you here who have already, the communication between you as a husband and a wife has begun to deteriorate. And if it keeps going that way, eventually what is going to happen? You're going to get up some morning, the kids are going to be gone, and you're going to sit across from a table from one another as total strangers. And some of you are going to opt for divorce because you think it's too much ground to try and make up. And friends, that is not the answer. The answer is to start working on it right now. If you know that you're in that boat, or if you see some danger signs in your relationship as a husband and a wife, start doing something about it now. Well, whose responsibility is it to do something about it now? Especially this area of communication. Whose responsibility is it? As a Christian. Well, the Bible is very clear on it. And let me show you. Ephesians chapter 5. There is absolutely no question about where the responsibility for the maintenance and ongoing of a good, healthy communication pattern between a husband and a wife lies. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 23. Now this whole passage, I wish if we had another day, we'd take this whole passage and dissect it, and we'd talk about the husband's responsibility and the wife's responsibility. But I'm just going to pick out one thing here as far as the husband's responsibility is concerned, because this area of communication is so vital. Verse 23, for the husband is the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church, his body, of which he is the Savior. Now, it's very interesting that in both the responsibilities that the husband is, that is placed here upon the husband, in both cases, it is compared to Christ. He is our example. You look at verse 25. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church. Okay, husbands, you're to be the head of the wife just as Christ was the head of the church. Now, just taking this one area of communication in terms of Christ's relationship to the church. Huh? Husbands, he is our example. The husband is to be the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church. Well, one of the responsibilities that a head or the leader has is to do something about communication. Any good leader, no matter what kind of leadership he's in, will develop good communication patterns in order to be the proper kind of leader and accomplish the objectives that need to be accomplished. Now, who took the initiative in communicating between Christ and His church? Who took the initiative in communicating between Christ and His church? Christ or the church? Huh? Christ did. All right, husbands, you're the head of your wives as who? Christ is the head of the church. He took the initiative in ensuring that there could be good communications between Himself and His church. He gave us this book. He took the initiative on that. All right, second question. Who takes the initiative in maintaining good communications between Christ and His church? Christ or the church? Christ does. Christ does. And He's always available. He makes Himself available. He's always ready to listen to us. He is always ready to speak to us. He's made it possible for us to communicate with Him at any time, and He is more than willing to communicate with us anytime. He's the initiator and He's the maintainer. Now, if He is our example as husbands, gentlemen, how in the world can we squeeze out from underneath that responsibility? We can't. There is no way that if we really want to be a husband who is living in obedience to the Word of God, we have got to ensure, we have the responsibility to ensure that there is good communication between me and my wife, between you and your wife. Biblically, that's where we are. And of course, the question is, are we going to live in obedience to God's Word? It's that simple. Now, that's a pretty potent thing. As Carol mentioned yesterday, 40% of troubled marriages are characterized by the silent husband. Guys, we got to learn to talk. Now, I realize that for some men, that's hard. It's hard for us to get in touch with our emotions and to be able to verbalize them and express them. But that's part of working at this relationship. Huh? I've had to work at that. I am not a natural talker. As Carol pointed out, revealing my inner thoughts and ideas and feelings does not come naturally for me. I've had to work at it. And as that big commercial push for ultra slim is going around now, you've seen that, I'm sure, these big time coaches and athletes, you know, if you can do it, if I can do it, you can do it. Huh? Well, you've got access to the same power of God that I do. It all depends on your motivation and your concern about this matter, doesn't it? That's what it boils down to. And then your willingness to take the bull by the horns and say, I am going to learn how to communicate. Whatever it takes, I'm going to learn. Because my wife needs it. We need it in our relationship. You see, no human relationship is built on silence. No human relationship. You can't build a friendship with somebody else who is a part of the human race without talking to each other. And the deeper the talking goes, the more intimate the communication becomes, the more you reveal of yourself to each other, the deeper your friendship is. It's just an automatic thing that happens. So it's just another aspect of this matter of communications that we've got to work at. One of the things that makes communication so hard, we've talked about a number of them, but one of them is a statement made by one of the outstanding experts in the world on the subject of communication, Dr. Eugene Nida. Some of you have probably heard of him. But if you haven't, let me give you a little of his credentials, just so I can impress you with who he really is. Okay? Dr. Eugene Nida has been translation secretary for the American Bible Society and director of the translations program for the United Bible Societies. He's a foremost linguist. He's worked in some 75 countries, producing texts in over 200 languages. Dr. Nida has written 22 books on translation, communication, anthropology, and missions. He's one of the outstanding authorities on communication in the world, with the secular world as well as in the evangelical world. Now, he's an expert. He knows what he's talking about, right? Here's what he says about communication. No two people ever mean exactly the same thing by the same word. No wonder it's so hard. Now, most of you sitting out there don't really believe that. I happen to believe it. And Carol and I have experienced it between the two of us. Let me repeat it. No two people ever mean exactly the same thing by the same word. Let me give you a little example. I'm going to say a word. The word head. H-E-A-D, head. Now, if I was to go around the room and ask about a half a dozen of you what came to your mind the minute I said the word head, my guess is that it's very possible we could have had six different answers, but probably at least four. For instance, some of you guys that have a Navy background, what'd you think of? Huh? Or you're in the cattle business, you know, heads of cattle. How many are you running, you know? That's what he means here. When you say a word, you have an idea in your mind what you mean by that word. But the person listening to you may hear that same word and go off on a completely different idea. Same word. See, we are so groomed to go by Webster's Dictionary in our society. The Webster's Dictionary definition of things. And we, our tendency is to believe that meanings are in words. Aren't we? We read it, I mean, that's why we use a dictionary. We look up the word. Well, the problem is you can't look up the word in the person. So meanings really are not in words, they're in people. And folks, if we could only get that through our minds, in our communication patterns with each other as a husband and a wife. That's why, as Carol was talking about it yesterday morning, that's why this idea of the feedback technique is so important. Well, if I'm understanding what you mean, it is, and then repeating back to the person what they've said in your own words, that gives them the opportunity to say, well, no, that isn't really what I had in mind, but maybe I could say it a different way. Well, I see what you're saying. What you mean is, and then you repeat it. We do this all the time. It's second nature to us. Why? Because we are interested in finding out what the other person means, not just what they said. And sometimes, to the other person, there is a vast difference between what they said and what they mean. Now, there are some of us in this room who are what I call literalists. Literalists. You are a Webster's Dictionary type of person. And when a person uses a word, it better mean exactly what Webster's Dictionary says it means, or they get nailed to the wall by you, because you are a literalist. How many times have you been eavesdropping or listening to a conversation with a married couple or somebody else, and there's a question on what has really been said, and the other person will finally say, "Well, that isn't what you said." Huh? You've probably done that to each other once in a while. "That isn't really what you said." Folks, that's not what is important. It's what they meant that was important. And if we're going to be so doggone literal that we're going to nail them to the wall with Webster's dictionary, then we're never going to find out what they mean. But rather come back with this feedback idea of drawing them out in order to get at what they're meaning. That's the goal. And that takes working at. It takes vulnerability, as Carol was pointing out. No two people ever mean exactly the same thing by the same word. It's just one of those other things that makes communication so difficult. Okay. Let me give you a couple of nevers with regards to communication, okay? These are no-nos. At least they are to us. I realize there's the possibility that there may be some of you here who can handle them, but we've discovered that we can't, and so we try to avoid them. Number one, never use sarcasm in kidding and joking with one another. Never use sarcasm in kidding and joking with one another. I would define sarcasm as humor at the expense of someone else. Sarcastic humor always has somebody else as the goat, the brunt of the joke. Don Rickles is a, you know, makes a good living at sarcastic humor. Many years ago, Carol and I had developed in our relationship, well, in the early days of our marriage, really, first couple of years, we had developed kind of a neat little way of joking and kidding with each other using sarcasm. And at first, it was totally harmless. We didn't mean anything by it. There were no hidden meetings. There were no double meetings. But as time went by, individually, we began to realize that this was a pretty nice tool to get in a little dig once in a while, and the other person wasn't really sure whether it was a dig or not. It was just maybe just humor. And so we gradually began to slip into that. And then the next progressive step in the development of this, our expertise in this field of sarcasm, was it got to the place of, can you top this type of thing? You know, I would make some sarcastic statement to Carol, and she felt she had to come back at me with one that was just a little bit better. And then sometimes I would feel, well, you know, I got to top that one. So I would come back at her, and then she, and sometimes we'd go back and forth two or three times like that. About that time, we began to realize that this was getting hurtful, that we really were at times hurting each other, and implying things that we really didn't mean. It was just kind of cute. Well, it was about that time, 2 years into our marriage, and I took a job during the second summer I was in seminary down in Dallas. I took a job as a youth pastor in a church out in Pasadena, California. And so we drove out there, spent the summer there in this church, and worked with this pastor and his wife, just a neat couple. Really enjoyed getting to know them and meeting them and working with them. And as the summer wore on and we were thrown together with them in all kinds of different situations, we observed their relationship as a husband and a wife. And they had a great thing going for them. They had a lot of fun together. They enjoyed each other. Obviously, were madly in love with one another. But before the summer was half over, we each individually realized that they, even though they kidded with each other, they never used sarcasm. And so one night we were out to dinner with them. And Carol and I had talked about this, and so we brought it up. We said, you know, we've watched you guys, and you have a lot of fun. You love each other, it's obvious. But you never use sarcasm in kidding and joking with each other. tell us about that. Well, they virtually repeated to us our story. The first 2 years they were married, they had fallen into the little habit of sarcasm, and then it grew and developed and became expertise in it, and then at Canutop, almost our identical story. I said, after about 2 to 2.5 years of that, we began to realize that this was becoming a harmful thing in our relationship. And so we decided to stop. And so we got down on our knees beside our bed one night. And we prayed and we asked the Lord for the courage and the strength and the wisdom and the sensitivity to stop being sarcastic to each other. And then we committed to one another we were going to stop it. To the point, they said, where we made ourselves vulnerable to one another to be called on it by the other person when we did it, because they were in the same boat we were. It was almost an unconscious thing by now. A sarcastic statement would come out and we weren't even aware of it. And they said that was hard because, you know, we'd be out with some couples and I would make a sarcastic statement to her or about her, and then we'd be on the way home and she would say to me, say, honey, you know, when you said, I said this and then you said this, and ooh, yeah, I'm sorry, honey, forgive me. They told us that it took them several months to break the habit. Well, we went home that night, we did the same thing. We got down on our knees beside our bed, we asked God for his help, we committed ourselves to one another to stop this, we even to this point of calling each other on it, not in front of other people, but after it was over. And we had the same experience. It took us several months to really become so sensitized to that we'd start to say something sarcastic and then we would stop. And so it has become something that we just think of as a no-no in our lives. Now, our problem is the same as yours. We're sinners. Huh? We're not perfect human beings. And so we blow it once in a while. But our goal is not to be sarcastic with each other. I hate to admit it, but I have made sarcastic statements to Carol since we have committed that. Not very often. And usually I am so sensitive to it, the minute it comes out of my mouth, I realize it. And she's the same way. In fact, I did it right at a marriage, in front of a marriage seminar one time. Can you believe that? I mean, you know, what I'm trying to impress on you, there's hope for all of us. We were at a seminar down in Missouri. And one of the guys who had come with his wife had been in the shoe business. And he had a good working relationship with some manufacturers. And so what they had done is they entitled the seminar The Marathon Marriage. And he had gone to some shoe manufacturers and had gotten some of these baby jogging shoes. And each couple there got a pair of those as a memento and a reminder of the weekend. And so the conference was over. It was the last meeting, right at the end of the last meeting, and they were presenting Carol and me with a pair of these little jogging shoes as a memento of this weekend. And we were very touched by this, and so I was thanking them, and I said, you know, I know exactly where Carol will put this. And I described Carol's memory wall in our house. We have one wall in our house that's up there, and that's her wall. She can do anything with it she wants to, and she's got stuff up there that's just memories of certain events and people and things. And I said, that's where Carol will put this little thing as a memory of this weekend. I said, she's got stuff like that all over the house where we've collected from around the world. And whenever she does, you know, once every 6 months or something, why? Oh, the minute that came out of my mouth, you know, I realized. And I just finished speaking on it. Well, I not only had to apologize to Carol, but I had to apologize to the whole bunch. That's a sarcastic statement. Dusting every 6 months at a good night. So, you know, we blow it. But never use sarcasm in kidding and joking with one another. That's one of those nevers that you got to modify just a little bit. Secondly, never criticize, correct, or interrupt him or her in public. Never criticize, correct, or interrupt him or her in public. That's a tough one. That is a tough one. How many times have you been in a social situation, and it gets to be with a group of other couples, and it gets to be storytelling time, and this one guy has got this terrific story. I mean, it's got everything in it. It's got mystery, intrigue, suspense, and his wife is giving him the elbow to tell his story, but he's a little shy, but finally he gives in. He starts to tell his story, and he really gets involved in it. And she gives him the hand on the knee treatment. Simmer down, I don't get carried away. And so, you know. And so then he does. Well, then it's his story, huh? And he leaves out something that he usually puts in. Well, then she reminds him of what he left out. About the third time, she interrupts him. The scenario often goes like this. He will turn to her with a disgusted look on his face and with a kind of a disgruntled tone of voice and say, well, why don't you finish it? You know. How does that make you feel when that type of thing happens right in front of you? How do you feel about him? How do you feel about her? Well, you kind of feel sorry for him and you'd like to choke her, you know? Yeah. Or how many times have you guys been in a car, maybe on the way to work or a fishing trip or something like that, with a bunch of other husbands, and they get to talking about their wives? The old bag, the ball and chain, and other derogatory remarks that they make or stories they may tell. Boy, whenever that happens to me, I praise God for Carol. And I try as best I can to embarrass the daylights out of every one of those guys by talking about my wife and how great she is. Never criticize, correct, or interrupt him or her in public. Correcting. I think that is probably the most common trait with American couples that is in existence today in America. I mean, it is so habit-forming. He is telling something, or she makes a statement, and for some reason or other, there's just an inner compulsion to get it right, you know? And it's usually some little dinky thing. Several years ago, we had a men's conference up in mid-Wisconsin. I guess it was southern Wisconsin, at Green Lake, Wisconsin, over Thanksgiving weekend. A fantastic conference. We had 987 men there, I think. Great gang of guys. It was just one of those explosive, dynamic weekends that God met us. Started Thursday night, ended Sunday at noon. Well, boy, when I got home, I took more than 10 minutes to tell Carol all about that conference. I waxed eloquent. And a couple of weeks later, I heard Carol telling a group of her friends, ladies, they were just standing there, and I happened to be eavesdropping on the conversation. She was telling them about this men's conference that we had had up at Green Lake, Wisconsin. And she was waxing eloquent, as only Carol can do. You know, there were just over 1,000 men there. And she went on like this, on and on, you know. And I thought to myself, now wait a minute, 987 men isn't just over 1,000, it's just under 1,000, right? I mean, you perfectionists in the crowd, you would recognize that. Now, what do you do in that kind of a situation when you find yourself in it? Well, I could have walked over there and said, excuse me, ladies, Carol, you know, I know she's excited about it, but she doesn't quite have the facts straight. It wasn't just over 1,000. It was just under 1,000 men that were there. And if you really want to know, it was really 987. Now, we know couples who do the equivalent of that constantly. They are constantly correcting each other on piddling little incidents that have absolutely no bearing on the world situation. Well, I've got a little secret that I'll share with you that I think is the proper attitude that we need as husbands and wives to take toward this thing. And that is what I call the 20-year view. In other words, 20 years from now, will it really make any difference to those ladies whether it was just over 1,000 or just under 1,000 men that were at that conference? And of course, most of the time, I would say 99% of the time, you're going to come out with the fact, no, it really won't make any difference 20 years from now. It's not that big a deal. And so I keep my mouth shut. Now, some of you perfectionists are sitting out there and you're saying, yeah, but what about when it is a big deal? And that's possible. You know, there are some giant mistakes that people can make in terms of getting their facts straight. You know, they could have said it was really Alaska and they said South Africa. I mean, that would make quite a bit of difference. Well, I think probably the proper way to handle that is just straighten it out a little later between the two of you. And then if it's a very critical issue and that group that heard South Africa instead of Alaska, why, maybe you can get in touch with them and let them know that. But not in front of them, huh? On rare, rare circumstances would you do that. So those are a couple of nevers that we need to keep in mind on communication. And one other thing before we get into this matter of conflict, and that is something that happens to all of us as married couples. What do we do about little idiosyncrasies that our spouses have, little habits they have, little ways of doing things, like this couple I was talking about last night, just a sec, you know, that type of thing. I mean, little deal. What do we do about those things that our spouse kind of habitually or occasionally do that really bug us? And we just, every time she does it, or every time he does it, or every time she says that particular thing that way, or vice versa, what do we do about it? Now, I'm talking about little things. For instance, we used to have one of these metal shower stalls in a place that we lived. One of these just square things with a glass door that opened like a regular door. It was in one corner of the bathroom, had a cold faucet and a hot faucet. And I would go in to take a shower on occasion, after Carol had taken a shower. And I would open the glass door, reach in and grab the faucets, you know, to get them adjusted just right before you get in, or you'd scald yourself or freeze to death. You had to get the water adjusted just right. And I'd reach in to get the faucets, and instead of getting the faucets, I would get a hold of a wet, soggy, cold, soapy washcloth hung over the faucets. Have you ever felt something like that, especially when it's kind of dim? The light isn't too good. I mean, it's really yucky. Ugh. It's a horrible feeling. Well, that happened several times. And finally, I realized we got to do something about this. So I picked what I felt was the proper time to talk to Carol about this. We were both very calm. Nothing was at odds between the two of us. We were just sitting having a great time together. And I said, honey, by the way, you know, there's something that has really been bothering me. And I was very gentle about it. I didn't get angry. I just brought it up and I explained to her what the problem was. She was very understanding. But she said, you know, honey, I guess probably the reason I do that is because there's no towel bar to hang the washcloth on close to the shower. And, you know, she was right. It was the only towel bar accessible to her was clear across the bathroom. Now, it wasn't that big a bathroom. I mean, two steps. But nevertheless, you know, I can understand that situation. She says, do you suppose you could get a little towel bar and put it up right outside the wall? She says, I think there's room there. I said, well, let's check it out. So the next day I went up and I looked, and sure enough, there was room on the wall right outside the door for a little 18-incher, you know. So I went down to the hardware store and got a little towel bar and some screws and put it on the wall, and it solved the problem. But what had to take place? Communication. We had to talk about it. We had to talk about it at the right time and at the right conditions, unemotionally. Not, hey, babe, can't you hang the washcloth somewhere else, you know? That is not the way to get cooperation. And I would do things from, or have done, I do still things from time to time that irk Carol, that kind of get on, little habits I get into. We have a chest of drawers in our bedroom. It stands about that high. It's got about 8 drawers in it. It's over in one corner of the bedroom. So it's kind of out of sight, out of line of vision and so forth. It's a kind of in an inconspicuous place in the bedroom. And so I had gotten into the habit of, when I go to bed at night, take off my pants. I still do take off my pants before I go to bed at night. But I would turn them upside down, put the cuffs together, open the top drawer of that chest of drawers, stick the cuffs in, close the drawer, and it's the neatest, quickest pants hanger I've ever discovered. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. Sometimes I'd get 2 or 3 pair of pants hanging in there. And on occasion, I would walk into the bedroom and be going toward the bathroom, which is to the right, and this chest of drawers was over in the other corner there. I'd walk into the bedroom and turn right, and out of the corner of my eye, I would catch Carol just kind of over there trying to get something out of that top drawer. And that was the problem. Of course, the top drawer was hers. Well, finally, she brought it up in a nice way and suggested that there was a proper garage in our bedroom for pants called a closet, and that that was where they really needed to be put at night. They felt more comfortable there. And she did it in a nice way. And I gave in. And I, okay, fine. But you know what she did? She went down to the hardware store, and she got me some metal pants hangers. They are the most ingenious thing I have ever seen in my life. They're better than toothpicks, and you know, toothpicks are quite ingenious. But you squeeze one point on them, and the two things come apart, and there's little rubber ends on it to clamp on the pants. And then you put the pants cuffs in, and you squeeze it another place, and it clamps on the pants, and then you just put it on the hook on the bar in the closet. It really is. I have to admit it. It's faster than the bureau drawer. And but see, we had to talk about it. Huh? We had to talk about it. Probably the number one problem in any household is, how do you handle single socks? It's incredible, isn't it? You take two socks off, you throw them in the clothes hamper or down the clothes chute, wherever they go in your house. They go through the process of the washer, the dryer, and then back to the drawer, and only one shows up. Incredible. For a long time, I thought that we had a Maytag washing machine that ate socks. But we've resolved that one. And that is that I just have a fairly large inventory of socks that keeps me supplied with clean socks. And you know, it's really funny. Carol has a little place down with a washer and dryer, a little cupboard above it, where when a single sock shows up, she just puts it up there. Eventually, the other one shows up. It just comes along later, somewhere along the line. It got stuck in the process. And then when the other one comes along, why, she puts them together and then puts them in my drawer. But the inventory, the large inventory of socks is the key to that, because sometimes two or three singles will get stacked up there, you know, and they don't match. So, and, you know, we've had people make all kinds of suggestions to us. Use big safety pins and pin them together so they can't get lost from each other. That's one way. Clothes pins, you know, put them together with clothes pins. But these are the types of little that we as married couples face all the time. And we got to work our way through them. We got to talk about them. It's part of the communication pattern. And we got to do it without getting mad at each other. They're such little deals. Why get mad over hanging a washcloth over the faucets? I mean, that's not world-shaking. But it is a problem. We got to deal with problems as married couples, huh? Okay, let's stand. Take a short stretch. Give your spouse a neck rub. And we'll be finished in about 20 minutes. Have a seat. And talk about conflict. How do we resolve conflict? A newly married couple had just gotten back from their honeymoon. They had settled in and were just into life well enough to begin to experience some of the dailies of married life. One morning, before the day had really even gotten started and before he'd left for work, she had done something that really irritated him, and he said to her, "I can't understand how God could have made you so beautiful and so dumb at the same time." Well, she was a smart enough little bride to realize that she better not try and top him on that one, so she just didn't say anything. That night they were sitting at supper, and she turned to him, and in a very sweet voice she said, "Sweetheart, I think I have an answer to the question that you asked this morning." And he had forgotten all about it, of course. And he kind of hemmed and hawed and wanted to know, well, what question was that? And she said, "Well, you know, the question that you had about you couldn't understand why it was that God made me so beautiful and so dumb." "Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, hon." "Well," she says, I think I've got an answer." He says, "Well, what's that?" And he says, "Well," she said, "well, the reason that God made me so beautiful is so that you would marry me." "And the reason he made me so dumb is so that I would marry you." Now, you know, they had some things to work through. That just started another conflict, didn't it? Huh? Sure. And we all face conflict in our marriage relationship. The thing is, how do we resolve them? Especially the kind that keep repeating themselves when a certain set of circumstances come together. And then we kind of have at it on the same issue again. And then those same set of circumstances arise and it happens again. Carol and I faced something like that a number of years ago, and I kind of want to use it as an illustration to help us understand this. And what I'm going to give you is a little 7-point outline on how to resolve conflict. Now, I'm almost apologetic for that, but not quite. Because I am not the kind of guy who believes that human beings are wired together in such a simple way that if you do step 1, step 2, step 3, step 4, step 5, step 6, draw the line, and then this will happen. We human beings, most of the time, are more complex than that. The difference is that this really works. As complex as we are, and we've not only seen it work with us, but we've seen it work with other couples. So I want to try and encourage you to latch onto this and at least give it a try. Because I know there are some of you out there that are wired together the same way I am. And that is that you have a hard time with little pat formulas. And ordinarily that is the way I am. But this really isn't a formula. It's just a procedure that will help us examine what's going on and try and come up with a solution that will meet both of our needs in a certain kind of conflict situation. Several years ago, while our daughter, Lynn, was probably about junior high age, I had a job with the Navigators that required me to travel quite a bit. We've even referred to it when I get home from a trip, you know, Carol would greet me warmly at the door and that type of thing. And that is exactly what would happen. I would be gone on a trip for 2 weeks, sometimes 3 weeks at a time. I'd come home, Carol would greet me warmly, and her first statement was, "Tell me all about the trip." And usually what would happen is that we would end up getting mad at each other because I didn't want to talk and she had a great need to talk. And that went on several times. I would go on trips, come home, and there she would be at the door waiting for me and she'd want to hear all about the trip. Until we got to the place finally where we realized that we had what I refer to as a generic problem. A generic in the sense that every time that set of circumstances transpires together, this same problem is going to arise. And I was going to keep traveling in my job. Hopefully I was going to keep coming home. I was pretty sure she was going to be there to greet me. And bingo. That was the set of circumstances. So what do you do? Well, I think the thing that really made us get so sensitized to it that we realized that we better do something about it was one night I got home, and the very night, well, it was a late afternoon, really, and she had invited company over for dinner that night. And that sort of corked it. That was more than I could bear. I made it through the evening, but after that we had to talk about it because we had a problem that was bugging me and it was bugging her, and we'd end up fighting about it, spending the evening mad at each other, make up before we went to bed. But that was getting to be quite a habit, and we knew that we needed to do something about it. So after that company for dinner thing happened, a couple of days later, I said, "Honey, we've got to sit down and talk about this. We've got to find an answer to this." Now, here are the steps that we went through. At that point in time, we didn't know these seven steps, but as we look back on it, we followed this exactly even without knowing what this was. The first thing we did was to define the problem or the issue of disagreement. Now, that's harder than it looks. For both of you to come to a written agreement on what the problem really is hard work. And I would suggest written agreement on what the problem is. Because you're not really going to get at the solution until you have accurately defined what the problem is. And here's what we decided was our problem. At that point in time, in other words, when I arrived at the front door, walked in, she threw her arms around me, gave me a hug and a kiss. At that point in time, our needs were greatly different than each other. Carol had a need for intimacy, closeness, communication, talk. She'd been home for 2 weeks with our young daughter, our dog, the washing machine, and as she said, dial a prayer. And some, you know, she wasn't kidding. I had a need for quietness, emotional distance, no talk. That's all I'd been doing when I was gone for 2 weeks. I was interacting with people. I was in meetings. I was counseling. I was working with a management team, making decisions, interacting with people. I'd had it up to here with people. Now, all of this came out as we talked about how do we define the problem. Then we began to a little bit understand what had been going on during that two-week period. Because, see, I had never stayed home with our daughter and our dog for 2 weeks without her being there. And she had never gone on a trip with me for 2 weeks to see what I did on a trip. So we just didn't know until we sat down and talked about it. And this is the definition that we came. At that point in time, our needs were greatly different. She needed much adult communication. She needed intimacy, closeness. I needed just the opposite. I wanted to be alone, quiet, not physically distant from her, but emotionally distant from her and Lynn and everybody else in town. And then I didn't want to talk. I'd been talking for 2 weeks straight. Quite a difference. I mean, how in the world do two people with such opposite needs come to some kind of an agreement where both those needs are met? Impossible, huh? No, it isn't. We found one. But we had to work at it. We had to work our way through this process in order to arrive at it. So step number two is to talk about how each of you contribute to the problem. Now, that will happen in the process of trying to define it. So one and two are kind of involved together. But you do have to get at that, how each of you contributed. And see, my contribution to the problem was for two weeks I was so involved with people that by the time I got home I was on overload. And Carol, of course, see, and I'm the introvert. So I'm out there with people. She's the extrovert. She's home by herself. That worked against us, just the way we were wired together. We couldn't do anything about that. But we did need to recognize how we contributed to the problem. Then you begin a very interesting process. You begin to brainstorm on possible solutions. Now, you know what brainstorming is. Brainstorming is just wild ideas. Anything that comes to your mind that might possibly work. Whether it sounds crazy, off the wall, out in left field, that doesn't matter. This is not the time for criticism or analysis. You don't, when you're in a brainstorming session, anything goes. The other person can't say, oh, that's a dumb idea, or that won't work. It might work. So you, here again, on paper, you begin to list all of these possible solutions, things that might lead to it. Then you begin to discuss each one of those solutions. After you've kind of brainstormed out, you go back and you begin to work your way through and you talk about them, the pros and cons. And this is where you begin to filter and sift and throw some out. Well, that might work. We'll keep that one, then you go through. Then the next two sort of go hand in hand, but they're a little slightly different. Agree on one solution to try, and then at the same time, you're agreeing on how each person will work toward the solution. So you pick one out of your discussion of number four, and then you begin to go into depth on that. Now, how will this work? How will each of us contribute? Well, in the process of doing number four, somewhere along the line, Carol made some, what at the time seemed to be an insignificant little statement, but we both came back to later. In the process of discussing one of the solutions, she says, well, you know, I've been at home by myself without talking to you for 2 weeks. I suppose I could last one more day. She just kind of made that off the cuff. And we didn't, at the time she made it, we didn't think much about it. But when we got down to here, agreeing on one solution and agreeing how each should participate, that idea became the key to unlock the solution. And I got to thinking about that, and I said to Carol, I said, do you really mean that? Could you wait 24 hours before I had to open up and talk? Would you be willing to give me 24 hours at home, get a good night's sleep in my own bed, get caught up on the mail, play with Muffy, the dog, watch a little TV, lay in the middle of the living room floor and stare up at the ceiling if I wanted to, you know, whatever I wanted, give me 24 hours, would you be willing to do that? And then I will commit to you that after that, you give me 24 hours, then I'll tell you all about the trip. We'll sit down, we'll talk, I'll answer all your questions, I'll take as much time as you want. I said, would you be willing to do that? Well, we talked it over, and she says, yeah, I could last 24 more hours. And I said, well, you know, I think that if I just had that little bit of a buffer, then by the next day, I would be really willing to take the time and in fact, be eager to dump the truck. And so we tried it. And of course, that's what, you know, agree on one solution to try how each of us was going to work toward the solution. We agreed on that. And so we tried it. And it worked. Now we had an impossible situation. Our needs, when I hit the front door, were entirely different. And yet through this little process of interacting with each other, without getting mad at each other unemotionally, talking about it, really committed to finding a solution, we came up with one that worked. Now, what if it doesn't work? Okay, you try one and it doesn't work, huh? We've had that happen. Well, you set a time to do a little review, and you decide that, you know, it isn't working. So then you go back to step three, and you start over again. You go. Hopefully you've kept all those brainstorming ideas. You've shoved those away in some folder someplace. And you may want to add to it and come up with some new ones. And then you work your way through four and five and six. And you try something different. Until, my guess is you wouldn't go through that more than three times maximum before you'd come up with a solution that really, really worked for the two of you. That met both of your needs in a conflict, a generic conflict type of thing. This is what we're talking about when we talk about working at our relationship. Because we all have conflicts, but how do we resolve them, see? Well, try it. We were sitting down in Texas 2-3 years ago with a young couple. They'd been married 14-15 years, I think. And we're sitting there at the dinner table, and they were telling us, we were talking about conflict, and they were telling us about a problem that they had. It was a conflict between the two of them that they thought was an absolutely impossible thing, so much so that they had totally given up on coming to any solution that would meet, satisfy both of them. And so we told them about this. And I asked him, I said, would you be willing to try it? I said, we got all evening. If you'd be willing to take a crack at it, let's do it. We'll just sit here and do it with you. Okay, fine. They agreed they didn't do that. We sat there for the next 2-2.5 hours, and we worked our way through these steps with them. I'll bet it took them 45 minutes to come up with a definition of the problem that they both agreed on. And of course, we got involved too, and we'd ask them questions and draw them out. But then once they got the problem defined that they agreed on, the rest of it almost became automatic. And before the evening was over, before that discussion was over, they sat there and looked at each other, and then they looked at us, and they said something like this, you know, we had given up on this. But we both feel now we've got a solution that will work. We just didn't think it was possible. Give it a try. I was talking with a group of men a couple of years ago. I was having lunch with them. It wasn't a formal lunch. It was a very informal lunch. We'd all brought our brown bags, and we were sitting around the table in a boardroom of this man's office. And we'd gotten together just for some spiritual fellowship and interacting with each other. And this boardroom that we were in was a law office boardroom. And the one man who I just met, who was the attorney, began to ask him what kind of law practice he was in and what he did and what kind of cases he ran into. And he says, "One of the interesting things, Jack, is that even though I'm in corporate law, I have a lot of people in town who come to me with divorce cases." He says, "They've heard that I'm somewhat empathetic and that I really try and mend things up between them. And so when they get to that point and they're desperate, I have many of them come to me for that, for counsel, for help." Well, we continued talking. Finally, I asked him this question. I said, "What is, in your experience in dealing with these people who are so desperate now, they've come to you and they're ready to get a divorce. I said, what is the number one issue that you run into? What has caused this? What has brought them to that desperate situation?" And without hesitation, here was his answer. And I wrote it down. It was so good. Here's what he said. "The biggest problem I run into is that people refuse to accept the fact that they're married to a human being." Boy, that's dynamite, huh? They refuse to accept the fact that they're married to a human being. Boy. They have in mind at the outset that they're going to change this person so that they will become someone they can live with. After several years, their marriage partner doesn't change, and so they opt for divorce. That situation is repeated over and over and over again in our country. Just remember, folks, you are a human being. You have faults. You have problems. You have shortcomings. And so does your spouse. But that's the joy. That's part of the adventure of marriage, is working our way through those things and recognizing the fact that we are human beings and we do have flaws. But letting our love grow for one another in spite of those flaws and working at it in such a way that it will grow. I want you to think about something right now, just right where you're sitting. How would you finish this phrase? If you were going to say it to your spouse, how would you finish it? "I thank God for you. Because." You were going to say that to your spouse. How would you end that in just a few words? "I thank God for you because." Got it? Okay, now what I want you to do is stand where you are. Hopefully you're next to your spouse. Turn to your spouse and then just very softly to each other, tell them what you just thought about. Standing, holding hands, we're going to close in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we do thank you for this weekend, and as we said at the outset, we do not feel that it is accidental that any of us are here. We feel that you have brought us here in accordance with your will for our lives. And one of the things that I pray for each of us as couples and as individual husbands and wives is that we have listened to you in these last few hours. And Lord, that we are committed, perhaps in some feeble way, perhaps in some great way, to begin to put into practice one or two or three of the things that you have spoken directly to us about while we've been here. And Lord, I want to pray for each one of the husbands who are here. I pray that you will bless each of them as provider of nourishment and raiment and sustain him in all of the exactions and the pressures of his battle for bread. Lord, may his strength be her protection, his character be her boast and her pride. And may he so live that she will find in him the haven for which the heart of a woman truly longs.
And Father, bless this loving wife. Give her a tenderness that will make her great, a deep sense of understanding, and a great faith in you. Give her that inner beauty of soul that never fades, that eternal youth that is found in holding fast the things that never age.
And then, Lord, make such assignments to them on the scroll of your will as will bless them and develop their characters as they walk together. Give them just enough tears to keep them tender, enough hurts to keep them humane, enough of failure to keep their hands clenched tightly in yours, and enough of success to make them sure that they walk with God.
May they never take each other's love for granted, but always experience that breathless wonder that exclaims, "Out of all this world, you have chosen me."
And then, Father, when life is done and the sun is setting, may they be found then as now, still hand in hand, still thanking God for each other. May they serve you happily, faithfully together, until at last one shall lay the other into the arms of God. These things we ask through Jesus Christ, the great lover of our souls. Amen.